Welcome back to Stacktrace, the podcast where we talk about Apple news, rumors, programming, technology, and many other things from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sandell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. Rambo, how does it feel to be recording episode number 1, 2, 3?
Well, it's easy as 1, 2, 3. I'm really happy.
There you go. So this episode will just be a breeze. We'll just chill right through it.
Yeah, thank you for listening. Till next week.
And we're going to kick it off with a very, very simple, easy, lightweight topic. Swift C++ interoperability.
I wouldn't call that 1, 2, 3. Definitely not. So tell me more. What have you been up to there?
So I've been working on a project recently that utilizes a underlying C++ engine to perform most of its kind of lower level work. And this is an architecture that is quite common, I would say, in general, where if you have an app that needs to run on multiple platforms, for example, or you know, people who are building things like games and other things that utilizes more kind of lower level code, it's very common for such apps and software in general to use a kind of shared C++ core, which is very, very often actually called core, which is kind of funny that all companies call it the same. And then you have the app layer written on top of that. So in the case of this project, there's this C++ engine, and then the app itself is an AppKit app written in Swift and Swift UI and AppKit and all of the good Apple stuff, right? So the challenge then is that how do you make your application code interface with this library code, like with this core C++ code? Back in the day of Objective-C, this was fairly straightforward, or there were at least a lot of options you could use in order to make this kind of interoperability happen, because what you could do is you could actually take your Objective-C implementation file, your .m file, and simply add another m to it. So it would become an .mm file, which would be an Objective-C++ file. And then what you could do is you could actually write C++ right there in your Objective-C code. You could pass your data directly between your C++ code and your Objective-C code. You could like have your Objective-C objects own C++ objects and so on. Like the fact that both Objective-C and C++ are like supersets of C, like they have that shared parent of C, if you will, opens up a lot of opportunities for just kind of calling this code directly from each other, which is really cool when you think about it. It's pretty wild that you can have one implementation file that includes Objective-C, C, and C++, like all just working together, right? That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, there's actually a very popular blog post. I believe it's on the PSPDFKit blog, where they talk about how you can have a lot of cool features from C++ while working with Objective-C, which actually makes working with Objective-C more Swifty or more C++-y in this case.
Right.
But yeah, that there are lots of cool features in C++ that you can use when you interface with Objective-C. And if you're in a code base that, for whatever reason, can't use Swift, which these days I think is extremely rare, you can still get a lot of benefits from integrating Objective-C and C++.
Yeah, for sure. But Swift, then, does not interoperate with C++ that kind of way. Like, you can't call your C++ code directly from your Swift code. You can't take your Swift file and rename it to like .swift++ or something. Like, that's not going to work because Swift is, you know, famously Objective-C without the C, right? So there's no C there. There's nothing to kind of act as a common ground for Swift and C++ like there is between Objective-C and C++.
Have you tried renaming it to Swift plus equals one? Because plus doesn't work in Swift.
Oh, right. That's what I should have done. Oh, that would have been so much easier than what I actually did. So the obvious route to go here perhaps would be to say, okay, since we know that Objective-C can interface with C++, and we know that Objective-C can also interface with Swift, because almost all of the frameworks that we use from Apple are actually not Swift frameworks. They are Objective-C frameworks, like UIKit, AppKit, and so on. Like, everything almost except for Swift UI and Combine and a few other like modern Apple frameworks, they're all Objective-C. So we know that we can definitely call Objective-C code from Swift, and it can even work really well, almost to the point where you almost don't notice that you are actually calling Objective-C code, even though you are under the hood, like it's just being translated into Swift. Yeah. So we know that works, and we know we can call our C++ code from Objective-C. So what we can do then is we can implement wrappers in Objective-C that then talk to our C++ code, and then our Swift code can talk to those Objective-C wrappers. So that way you have this kind of layered architecture where your Objective-C layer is aware of the C++ core, and then your Swift code can just talk to those intermediate Objective-C objects, which has some benefits in terms of the kind of architecture and general kind of simplicity, just in terms of, you know, not having too many languages interface with each other. You have those more clean interfaces, but it does have a downside, which is that you have to then allocate all of those Objective-C objects, which can cost some performance. Like you might not get as good performance as, you know, when calling a C++ library directly, because you always have to go through Objective-C, which is much more dynamic and does a lot more things during the runtime and so on. You might have a much higher memory overhead because you need all those NS objects being allocated and so on. So there are upsides and downsides, like always.
Yeah, as always, it depends, right?
Exactly.
What you could do in that case, I would think maybe instead of doing like a one-to-one mapping between your Swift Objective-C and then C++ code, you could actually write an abstraction using Objective-C, which I guess is what you're doing in your case. And then the lower level calls would be abstracted, so you would still get a lot of benefits. And it's just at the intersection where you would probably lose a little bit of your performance, which in reality, like, it's probably gonna be fine. Like, it's probably not something that's called every millisecond or that needs to render at 60 hertz or 120 hertz. So I guess you're gonna be fine there.
Yeah, it's definitely a good option. So what you're saying there, I think, makes a lot of sense, where you can create almost like a service in Objective-C, right? That then talks to your C++ code, and you don't have that one-to-one map between all of your C++ objects and your Objective-C objects. So that makes sense. It will save you a lot of memory as well to do that. And then you will write more code in Objective-C, I guess, because that service layer will have to do a little bit more work. It won't just be like a translation layer. But it's definitely a route you can go. And a lot of companies go this route. And, you know, I've done this in the past as well. But it's actually not what I went for in this project. So in this project, what I did instead was, one thing that's also good to keep in mind is that Swift can also interface with C, not just with Objective-C. So you can call C functions directly from Swift. And since C++ is really C with some extra stuff, some plus plus on top of it, right? That means that you can use C headers for your C++ code. So the header files that you will use can be quote-unquote pure C, and then your implementation can be C++. So as long as you don't have any C++ code in your actual header files, which is not usually at least necessary if you need to write like a more kind of umbrella header or an API interface, then you're actually dealing with just C code from the point of view of Swift, which means that Swift can then actually directly call that code without needing any Objective-C wrappers or anything like that. But there is, of course, caveats and trade-offs, like always. And the caveat here would be that if you just take those C APIs, which will probably just be global functions, because C doesn't have like objects and methods and those sorts of things, it has basically structs, enums, pointers, unions, and functions, right? That's what C has. So when you import that code and you start calling it, it will be really awkward to use that in Swift, because even if we don't do like the kind of object-oriented programming in Swift so much anymore that we used to do, where we have like these deep class hierarchies with lots of subclassing and so on, we're still using very object-oriented patterns in Swift. Even if we're dealing with structs, we have, you know, methods and properties and types which we instantiate and so on. So having just everything be global functions and pointers and so on, it's not very nice and convenient. It doesn't feel very Swift native. But another twist here in the story, it's a very twisty story here, Izzy Rambo. What you can do then is what Apple does for some of their C APIs. If you take, for example, Core Graphics, in Core Graphics, you have CG Rect, you have CG Point, and so on. And those you can actually work with in Swift as if they were Swift types, as if they were just normal Swift structs. You can create values from them, you can call methods on them, you can set properties on them. And those then actually just get translated into those C calls, like those C functions that are powering this library. And you can do the same thing with your code. You can use some annotations, specifically CF_Swift_name, to pretend that those C functions and C types are actually proper Swift types. And that way, you'll be able to call your C and in turn C++ code as if it was Swift code. And this for me is like incredibly cool. I think it's so cool that you can take a language, which is, you know, very modern, and you can use a language from decades ago, C, and another language which is also old and very established, C++, and you can make that whole chain just like work together with some annotations just completely seamlessly without any wrappers, without any kind of translation layers you have to implement yourself, all just work seamlessly together. I think that's just incredibly cool.
Yeah, I also love that as well. And it's one of the things I like the most about programming in general, especially at a higher level, and something that I think our non-developer listeners might appreciate is that pretty much in software development, you're always building on top of something that already exists. Pretty much all the time. Like it's very rare that you're going to be doing bare metal stuff, because even if you're writing assembly code, you're building on top of the processor, which does a bunch of stuff for you. So that is very interesting. And also something else that's a takeaway from this is that a lot of the cool stuff Apple does with their APIs, like the old Core Graphics APIs, like I mentioned, we can also do as well. So if you have some C API that you use and you're not happy with how it interfaces with Swift, you don't need to write an Objective-C wrapper around it. You can do the same trick as Apple does.
Exactly. And this is really how I found out about these things. I was just looking at the headers for things like Core Graphics and other C libraries that Apple provides, and just looked at how they make those translate into Swift. And like you say, it's not some specific like hard-coded thing in the compiler. These are attributes that we can use, and we can implement them ourselves and make our code translate just as well. And I just think it's so useful, and I think Apple deserves a lot of credit for this kind of interoperability that is so strong. And it really, like you also mentioned, it lets us build on things that already exist. We don't have to rewrite everything. Even if we might want to build our app in Swift, we can utilize all this other code that exists or might be built by other people or might be cross-platform in something like C++, and it can just integrate with our Swift code really beautifully. And in my UI code, like in the Swift UI code that I'm writing, I have no idea or no indication that I'm actually dealing with C code and C++ code under the hood, because my Swift code is just normal Swift code.
Yeah, that's absolutely beautiful. And I'm sure you're very happy with your solution, right?
I am very happy with my solution because it's all, you know, static, it's fast, it's nice, you know, not a lot of layers of abstraction. Yeah, I love it.
Awesome.
Cool. And what have you been up to lately? I've heard that you've been working on AirBuddy, and how's your humidifier hack going? It seems like you're still alive, so that's a good indication.
Yeah, I'm still alive. I still have a roof over my head. That's always a good sign. Yeah. So I had a bit of an oops with the AirBuddy 2.3 beta, which I'm running right now. And the backstory here is that my beta builds expire. Just like Apple's, iOS betas, a new iOS beta is now available. Please update. You know that. So
right.
With AirBuddy, and I tend to do this with all of my Mac betas, I always have a hard-coded expiration date. And when the app hits that expiration date, it just kills itself. And if you run it, it shows a dialogue and it says, hey, this beta has expired. Please download the latest beta. And that's it. And the reason for that, there are multiple reasons, but the main one is I don't want people to be running like a AirBuddy 2 beta 1 in 2021. And that will absolutely happen if your betas never expire. And also, if that binary ends up in someone's hands, I don't want people to be using that after a while. So betas expire. The problem is that the first beta of AirBuddy 2.3 expired this Monday, February 15th. But it wasn't released that long ago. And the expiration date is usually like 5 months after the build is released. And the problem here and the lesson is that I was not updating this expiration date automatically. I was doing it manually. And of course, when I issued the build for the first beta, which was in mid-January, I think, I had forgotten to change the expiration date, and so this happened. And unfortunately, this is just something for beta, so it's for people who are testing, and testers are used to this sort of thing, but I would have preferred for it to not have happened, of course. But yeah, it's all fine now. I have issued an update, and I now have a little script that automatically updates the expiration dates before issuing a new build of a beta of AirBuddy.
Yeah, that sounds good. It's definitely one of those things that's super easy to forget, right?
Yep.
Because you just want to get the beta out of the door, and if you have to then remember to always update the expiration date, like that's always going to be something you're going to forget sooner or later.
And it seems like Apple has the same issue and they haven't fixed it yet, because every now and then there's an iOS beta that will start bothering people with, please update, even when there is no update.
Right. Yeah. Does it make sense for you to also kind of check, do some kind of network call to check if there is a new beta available before you do this kind of, you know, short-circuiting the app itself? Or just checking the date you think is a better solution?
There are definitely better solutions, but this is one of those cases where this is not a high priority. So just fixing it so that I can't forget to update the expiration date again was a lot easier. But yeah, there's definitely stuff I could be doing here. One thing I am probably going to do is add the alert that shows up before the app short circuits, it sends the user to a URL where they can get the latest beta. So that, like, even though the app is now useless, you can go and get the latest beta. So you don't have to like check your email or something like that for the new build. But hopefully this will never happen again. It will only happen if you happen to install a beta and never update for half a year or something, which is extremely rare.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And what about your humidifier hack then? How's that going?
Yeah, so I've been playing around with the building blocks still. I still haven't put together the full hardware. So I have the hardware interface with the actual hardware on the humidifier. That's all working. And I also have the software side of things mostly working in terms of HomeKit. So I'm using the ESP8266 controller, which is a microcontroller that integrates Bluetooth and also has Wi-Fi. And that means that it can actually run HomeKit directly. So you don't need a bridge. And it's a tiny little bar that I can use. So it will run the HomeKit accessory protocol through a library, which is based on Apple's code. And it's actually funny that it kind of uses declarative programming in C to declare like your HomeKit accessory in code. And that's all like a bunch of macros that Apple builds in order for you to declare your HomeKit accessory. So yeah, I've been doing that and it's a lot of fun. And I've also been playing around with the Bluetooth stack on this board, which I probably won't be using for this project, but I felt like it would be fun to play around with it. So I got this little ESP32 board that includes an OLED display, and I made a little SwiftUI app where I can basically type in a text field and the message shows up in the OLED display, and that's all over Bluetooth Low Energy.
Oh, very cool. Nice. You're migrating now to networking, right? Like first it was all using HomeKit, and now you are going to Bluetooth. What's going to be next? Wi-Fi, internet connectivity? Maybe you're building your own router eventually, Rambo.
That would be fun, actually. So this is fun, and it's always fun to integrate these quote old APIs, such as Core Bluetooth in this case, with SwiftUI, because even though the underlying code is still the same and you're still interacting with things such as Core Bluetooth using delegates and things like that, you can expose a much nicer API to your user interface. And there's something beautiful about just having an environment object or an observed object or something of that kind in your SwiftUI view, and something in the physical world, like the presence of a given device nearby, makes things change. And I should be used to that with AirBuddy, but AirBuddy doesn't use SwiftUI in that way. The main app UI is still all AppKit. So it's always very satisfying to integrate SwiftUI into these old APIs. And I'm calling them old because they're not like declarative or Swift, but they're not that old, actually.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. And it kind of ties back to my interoperability story from the beginning of this episode, where It is really nice and beautiful when you can integrate these very, very different pieces of technology and just have them work seamlessly with each other. And one thing I really like also with this kind of work that you've been doing is that you can sort of spend most of your time in the model layer, right? Mm-hmm. Where you can focus on the integration between Core Bluetooth, in this case, and your application. And then you write that, you package that up into this observable object, and then your SwiftUI view just takes that observable object, hooks into it, either using state object or observed object, and then you write your UI, and it all just works. Like, that part is so satisfying, where, you know, when doing UI development using other frameworks, including like UIKit and AppKit and so on, it's very, very rare, even though I've been doing this kind of UI development for like over a decade at this point, it's really rare for me to just get it right on the first time, right? Yeah. I will always like have some UI bugs where I forgot to set the translate auto layout constraints into constraints auto resizing mask equals false. You know, I always forget something like that. And then I end up with like a blank UI or a UI that doesn't look right. And I have to go back and debug it and so on. So having that, like having you able to like spend the time with your model code, making sure that works right, you can write some unit tests and so on. And then you just put in your view and it just works. It's really satisfying.
Yeah, and like little layout glitches and misuse of SwiftUI aside, assuming your model code is correct, your UI will be correct. That's like the nature of declarative programming. So I can spend, like you mentioned, most of my time making sure that my model is correct. And as soon as my model is correct, I can put a UI together really quickly, especially since this is a little side project. So it doesn't have to be like a beautiful UI. It can be just a simple, plain UI. And this is a case where if I didn't have SwiftUI, I probably wouldn't even have a UI at all. I would just like put like a direct call in application did finish launching just to see it working. But I wouldn't bother to create a UI. But since I have SwiftUI, I actually bothered to create a UI, and it actually like shows a little spinner while it's connecting to the device, which I would definitely not do if this was UIKit. It would be too much work.
Yeah.
And with every keystroke, that binding basically means that with every keystroke, it's sending It's writing to the characteristic on my Bluetooth Low Energy device, which, like, in UIKit, I would have to, like, write a delegate for the text field, and that's just too much of a hassle. So, yeah, SwiftUI definitely makes these sorts of things a lot more fun.
Yeah, it really does, and it also removes so much of the friction of just, like, getting started and building something. You can just start building a UI and see where it goes, right? And you can come up with some new ideas as you're building it. And I also think this relates to one of the articles that you wrote quite a long time ago now, where you said, like, you can use Swift UI today or something like that.
Yeah.
Where it was about, like, you can build your own internal tools and things like that using it, because often it's actually faster to build a proper app with a proper UI than to just write a command line tool, which is also pretty mind-blowing if you think about it.
Yeah, and speaking of command line tools, actually, that's true, but with the argument parser API, I've been writing command line tools more often than I had in the past, especially using Swift. The argument parser library kind of makes me want to write my command line tools in Swift instead of Objective-C, which I used to do back in the day.
Yeah, it's also a great library, and it also follows a very declarative model, right? Like, so yeah. It's really that power of having those building blocks that you typically would need a lot of boilerplate to set up otherwise, just having them be solved for you. And then you can focus on your logic and your kind of scripting and the things you want to do. And in this case, you can focus on the Bluetooth bridge and just have that work. And then the UI kind of almost becomes an implementation detail.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So now with those updates, we've been doing some really low-level programming this week, Rambo. It's really cool. Sometimes it's really nice to dive deep and not just work in the realm of Swift, but, you know, move outside and explore the wider world. Speaking of the world, what do you have for us this week in terms of in the news?
I have some bit of sad news, I guess, for most people. Google has discontinued Swift for TensorFlow.
Oh, yeah, that's too bad, really. And it's another project that Google has canceled, right? That's it's almost becoming a meme at this point that they're canceling projects very often.
Well, it is actually a meme. There's this website called killedbygoogle.com.
And right.
It basically lists a bunch of stuff that Google is in the process of discontinuing or has discontinued. I don't see Swift for TensorFlow there yet, but we'll see if they add that in. But I think this is a good opportunity for us to discuss a little bit not only what this means for our community and Swift in general, but also why are big tech companies discontinuing projects all of a sudden, even though they seemed very interested in them?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting from an external point of view, because the only thing you see, you don't have any insight into the kind of internal discussions around priorities and things like that in a big company. So what you're just seeing is, you know, Google, in this case, promoting this technology, Swift for TensorFlow. They have like a really nice website for it. They have all these tutorials for it. They have integrations and so on. Like, it really looks like something that's going to be maintained and supported for a long time, like a really official product that is very polished and, you know, something you can use. And then it just feels like it goes from night to day or day to night, I guess. And it just like all of a sudden it's just gone, or it's not gone, but, you know, it gets deprecated or discontinued. And sometimes there's like a grace period. They announce something, you know, beforehand and they say, you know, we're going to discontinue this in 1 year or in 6 months or something. But sometimes it's just very sudden. And that can really feel shocking, especially if you're a person using some of these technologies that, you know, you didn't see it coming. And it really feels like, you know, something strange that it just happened out of a sudden. But it is really interesting then, and also kind of important to think about, like, why are these things happening? Like, what's going on here? And so often, I think it just comes down to internal priorities within some of these big companies. And I don't have any insight into this particular instance, but I have worked for big companies myself. I have been a part of working on technologies that then have been deprecated. And I just know in general kind of how these things typically go. So big companies, they will typically pursue a lot of different ideas and a lot of different projects. And that's especially true of Google. You know, yeah. We do make fun of them for killing a lot of projects and discontinuing a lot of projects, but you also have to give them some credit that they're also trying a lot of things, right? Like yeah. They are trying so many things, and they're experimenting a lot in the open too. And Swift for TensorFlow was no exception. Like, I loved just how open they were with the development process. Like, they even had all of their discussions and design meetings and everything were all available for anyone to join, which is, really cool. And, whole project was open source and so on. So that's really nice, like, that they are able to do that kind of experimentation and work in the open and so on. But then on the other hand, you also have in big companies a lot of shifting priorities. And eventually there will come a point where the company will ask themselves, is this particular project really kind of business critical, or is it, empowering some of our business critical projects or operations? Is this something that we really need? And in the case for Swift for TensorFlow, I guess the decision was just made to say, we definitely want to invest in TensorFlow as a technology, but do we really need this first-class Swift support? Because if you think about it, it doesn't really seem like something Google would do, right? Like that they would provide first-class support for Apple's primarily programming language for their machine learning framework. So I'm not that surprised that this eventually got deprecated or discontinued, because if you think about it, it is a little bit strange that it even existed in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. But the other question I have now is Swift doomed?
Oh, wow. Not to go anywhere dramatic, right, Rambo?
No, definitely not. And to be fair, I'm only asking this because I'm sure some people have proposed this in connection to this news, because as we know, like with every piece of news online, people tend to be creative. So what's your take on that?
So I think it's important not to read too many things into completely unrelated things, right? Like this yeah. happens all the time when some big company makes a decision. Like it happened when, for example, IBM, they stopped supporting server-side Swift officially. Mm-hmm. And now we have the same thing here with TensorFlow. It doesn't mean that Google doesn't believe in Swift, or that the people working on this no longer believes in Swift for TensorFlow or Swift as a language. I think it's very dangerous to read into these things into this kind of announcements, because what I was kind of alluding to earlier is that these things, when projects gets discontinued, it typically has almost nothing to do with the actual technical implementation. It certainly usually isn't the decision of the people working on it. It's typically a decision that happens higher up in the org chart, where it's just a matter of priorities and, economy and these sorts of things, where it's like, we have this project that we're investing in. Do we really need to keep investing in it, or can we use something else? Because even though companies like Google and other big companies are continuously experimenting and investing and trying new things, they also always need to optimize their operations. And if they're spending money on something that they don't need to spend money on, they will typically optimize that away.
Yeah, the way this works is, and again, I'm not saying this is what happened at Google. We're not at Google. We don't know. But in general, the way things work is there's someone in charge of making sure a particular segment of the business is doing well, both in terms of productivity and financially. So at some point, someone looked at a spreadsheet and there was this Swift for TensorFlow item on the spreadsheet, and it was spending this much and it was costing this much in terms of work hours from the people involved. And they had the task of, oh, we need to get back X amount of dollars per year or something. And they looked at it and they were like, what's Swift for TensorFlow again? Do we need this?
Right.
So, yeah, and I'm not saying that this is exactly what happened here, but it might have been something as simple as that. And
right.
It has nothing to do with the technical merits of the technology involved.
Exactly. Because we always have to ask ourselves, like, what's the motivation for a company to continue to maintain a given piece of technology? Is Google's mission to be like a first-class supporter of Swift tooling? Probably not, right? Like I mentioned earlier, they're definitely, I think, continuing to investigate in TensorFlow as a technology, because machine learning is incredibly important to them. It's very business critical. It's powering so many of their products. And it's also providing them with like this development platform around it, and it's very successful. So I think TensorFlow as a project itself is pretty safe. But then we have this Swift for TensorFlow, which is kind of a niche thing if you think about it. And like you said, like it could have just been a simple matter of, do we really need this for TensorFlow to succeed? No, we don't. Okay, let's cut it because it's not really required anymore. And typically these things can happen on a kind of ongoing basis where you have to, as a person who wants to work on something in a big company, you have to kind of continue to justify it because it is spending company time and money. And if you don't have that kind of quote unquote internal champion for a particular project, then that project might eventually get killed. And in this case, you know, why did Google even pursue this? Well, they had Chris Lattner working on this, you know, the creator of Swift, right? And I don't think it was a case where they hired Chris and Chris said, you know, let's use Swift, right? Where there probably was something there where they wanted to use Swift and Chris was a really good person to work on it because he created the language, right? Yeah. But when Chris left and then, you know, maybe some other people left and so on, maybe there just wasn't anyone inside of Google to kind of, you know, be the champion for this project. So there was just no one to kind of defend it against the spreadsheet people.
Yeah, so I guess in summary, it was basically a strategy that they had involving Swift for TensorFlow, but it didn't make sense anymore in the current environment, basically.
Yeah, and this happens all the time in big companies, and that's why I'm careful not to read into too much into these decisions, because again, it might have nothing to do at all with the technology or the people who created it or worked on it and so on. It definitely shouldn't be seen as like Swift can't be used for machine learning. You know, that's definitely not what it is. And if you look at the repo also, Swift for TensorFlow, they are listing some of the kind of accomplishments of this particular project. And we actually got a lot of great new Swift features out of this project as well. Like they have been contributing a lot to the community and made the Swift compiler and the language itself like better. So take something like dynamic member lookup, for example, which is something I love to use with key paths to, you know, avoid a lot of boilerplate code, and that you can take one of your objects kind of and proxy it to another object that it owns so that you don't have to write those manual getters and setters. It's also really useful when doing these kind of interoperability and layering and things like that we talked about earlier in this episode. That came out of the Swift for TensorFlow project. And there was like the Python interoperability and lots of other things. So I think it was definitely like a great project that it existed and a really interesting project. And I don't see it as a huge failure that it's been discontinued. It's sad, of course, because I would love for it to continue. But I try not to read too much into kind of what it means for the future of Swift.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good approach. Also, it's possible that development will still be done by other parties, right? It's not like they closed down the repo, at least not that I know of.
No, exactly. And that's something that's important to keep in mind, is that when you have something that is open source, of course, depending on the license and so on, but the community always has the opportunity to fork it and continue to maintain it and work on it. To be honest, that typically doesn't happen, because yeah. Typically when you have like a company like this investing in it and taking ownership of it, it tends to kind of stagnate after the company can't invest in it anymore for some reason. So I wouldn't keep my hopes up that that's going to happen. But, you know, if someone is out there listening to the show today who is really passionate about Swift for TensorFlow, then maybe you should, you know, take it on and start maintaining it again.
And credit Stacktrace.
Exactly. All right, so that was a really interesting discussion about Swift for TensorFlow and what might have happened and what led to the discontinuation of it. But let's see what's going to happen in the near future around it and its ecosystem and those sorts of things. But now let's move on to our Ask Stacktrace segment. And for this week, we have a little bit longer question. It comes from Andrew. I think it's a very good question. So I'm actually going to read the whole thing. It's a little bit long, but I think it provides some good context to this question.
Awesome.
Andrew says, do you think it's a bad idea to have the code base for a monetized app openly available on GitHub? So speaking of open source, I develop an iOS app on the side, that's Andrew saying this, and I'm planning to introduce a paid plan for some extra features. The app's code base has been openly available on GitHub for its whole lifetime, And I'm wondering whether or not I should make it private now. I'm not sure what the risks are of leaving it public. Could perhaps some company or individual make a copycat app, or that individuals might sideload the app to get around the paywall, or are there any inherent issues with charging for open source software? So, that was a long question, but it's a really interesting discussion point. So, Rambo, do you think in general that there are any downsides of having an app that you want to monetize being available on GitHub, like in terms of the source code being open source?
Well, this is quite a tricky question because, as usual, the answer is it depends, but this depends on a bunch of different levels. So, I would say, in general, that would not be a problem. Your source code is not that special, and this is nothing personal, Andrew. I say the same about my own source code. Like, if someone got the source code for one of my apps, yeah, they could release the app in the App Store or whatever, but that doesn't make it the same as my app, even though the source code is technically the same. But besides that, in the case of the App Store has policies against spam, basically, and against people resubmitting the same app. So if you are the owner of the open source code, you get to dictate the terms of how that code can be used. And this depends, of course, on what license you're using. But even if you're if you have one of the classic open source licenses like BSD or MIT or something like that, you could very well add a statement to your license that this code cannot be used for competitors or something like that. And again, talk to a lawyer. Like, I'm not a lawyer,
right?
But it would be good to do that in this case because this is some tricky copyright issue. But in general, if that happens, you can get in touch with Apple and get the offending app removed. That can very easily become a game of whack-a-mole, and you're going to get an app removed and another one will pop in. I did have this happen with one of my open source projects, which did not have a paid plan involved. I think it was Podcast Menu, which was this little app that embedded Overcast in your menu bar. I'm not maintaining it anymore, but I remember that I did find a bunch of apps in the App Store that were basically Podcast Menu, and they had like in-app purchases and things like that. And in that case, I didn't do anything because my license technically allowed for that. And also, I wasn't losing any money because of that, because the app was free on GitHub. So yeah, it depends a lot. Personally, I wouldn't do it. I would not have the source code of an app that I plan on making money off of on GitHub openly available, just to avoid these sorts of issues. And not to scare anyone, but I do remember at least one case where the copycat got the original developer kicked off the App Store.
Right, so, yeah.
So in general, I would suggest if you plan on making money off of an app in the App Store, do not keep the code openly available on GitHub. There's a compromise in which you could maybe, and this again, this will depend a lot on how your app is architected, but you could maybe have all of the code for the free stuff available on GitHub, but everything that's behind the paywall, you keep hidden, you keep private in a separate repo. But that poses a lot of other issues with like synchronizing and yeah, architecting that. So I would suggest not doing it.
Yeah, I would suggest the same in general as well. And there are many other ways that you can open source your code. Like you could, like you also mentioned, Rambo, like you could open source a part of it or maybe extract some part of it that you think could be usable to other people into something like a library. And then you could open source that library. Of course, that does require some code changes and it might not be so straightforward. But it could be a way to share some of your code with the community if that's what you want to do, while still keeping your app itself private. And I think a good example of this from me has been, well, first of all, I've been continuously open sourcing lots of different libraries that I've been developing as I've been developing apps, things like my files library, for example, and Unbox back in the day and those sorts of things. But a more recent example is Publish. If you look at my website is not open source and it will probably never be open source because I don't want to also have the overhead of always like maintaining an open kind of workflow as well, because having something be open source is not just making the source code available, it's how you are working on the project as well. And when it comes to my website, I want to be able to move like really fast on that. I want to be able to just do it on my own in my own little sphere without having to like share that with the whole world. But I was more than happy to open source the entire engine of my website, Publish. And if you look at the overall kind of source code of my website, I would say that Publish probably accounts for like 90% of it, right? Like yeah. Swift by Sandell is just an implementation of Publish. So that's another route you can go. And I think it's very important when you are doing open source in general to ask yourself, it's kind of like back to our discussion with TensorFlow, you have to ask yourself, even though you're not a big company, but you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? Like, why do I want this to be open source? Is it because I want to share it with other people for learning or something? Is it because I think that other people might use my source code? Is it because I want to have like a portfolio or something in case you're looking for a job and you want your source code to be available? You know, there are many reasons why you might want to do something like this, but I think it's very important that you make those reasons clear to yourself, because it is going to be a risk perhaps of having it open source. It's going to be a cost in terms of your workflow and so on. So it is important to get those priorities straight, I think. And another thing also, you talked a little bit there, Rambo, about licensing. And we're not lawyers, again, so you know, this is not legal advice. But it is really important to pick a good license, because like you also mentioned, like if you pick a license that actually legally allows someone to use your code, then you can't be upset when they use your code, because you explicitly give them permission to do it. So I've seen some cases where people have open sourced their apps and then they've been really upset when someone launched a, you know, copy or modified version of that source code on the App Store. But if the license allow them to do that, then, well, you allow that. So it is kind of tricky. And I wouldn't personally do it either. I like to keep a good separation between what I'm doing, you know, in terms of my own projects and what I'm doing for my business and so on, and what I'm sharing with the community. I am more than happy to share my code with the community, but I don't want to share all of my code.
Yeah, and just to be clear there, you're allowed to be upset. You just can't do anything about it legally.
Yeah, exactly. I guess what I mean is that, yeah, you can't do anything legally, and it's almost like, you know, you put yourself in the situation, right? And of course, hindsight is always 20/20 and so on. It's easy to think about something, you know, once you've made a mistake and so on in retrospect. But I think, you know, as much as possible, try to think these things through beforehand, because it might have some big consequences.
Absolutely.
Cool. So hope that advice there or that discussion is useful to you, Andrew. And yeah, hope that everything will work out with your app as well. If you want to ask us a question for the show, you can do so by tweeting with the hashtag AskStackTrace. And you can also email us at stacktrace@9to5mac.com. We read all of your tweets and all your emails and everything that we get. And we also love to hear feedback as well. So feel free to send us anything you have. And we also love to answer your questions on the show also. Having you kind of influence some of these topics and ask us when you want us to go into more detail around certain things is really helpful as we are planning the show. So feel free to keep that up. And if you have anything that you would like us to talk about, just tweet at us and we will probably talk about it at some point. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is for you to say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.